This is Passing Judgment, a podcast about the law and how it affects you. I'm your host, Loyola Law School professor Jessica Levinson. Think of me as your personal law professor as we navigate the big legal questions of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers. Hey, everybody, it's Jessica. And this week, we are going to bring you an exciting update about voting rights. We've talked about this before, some of the big cases pending before the Supreme Court. There's somebody who I've wanted to have on the podcast for a while. He's here now, Hansi Lo Wang. He is a correspondent who joined NPR in 2010. He reports on how elections, the census, and the Postal Service and other parts of the U.S. government work. That is a lot to do. His reporting on the 2020 census earned him the Society of Professional Journalists Sigma Delta Chi Award and the American Statistical Association's Excellence in Statistical Reporting Award and a National Headliner Award. Hansi, thank you so much for being here. Thank you for passing judgment with us.
Thank you for having me on. Thank you for that kind introduction. I feel like I should be on the other end of the microphone interviewing you.
I appreciate that, but I am here to learn just like everybody else. And I actually want to start out with talking about what your daily life looks like before we get into the nitty-gritty of the going to focus on the Louisiana case that's pending before the Supreme Court, maybe talk about some other issues that are just to the side of that. But what is a day in the life like for you?
It's a little hard to say. It kind of changes every day. A lot of things happening at once. We have a general election coming up very soon. So gearing up to kind of look at any potential voting issues that might pop up at polling places, mail-in voting issues, while also keeping an eye on lawsuits such as this Louisiana case. That's a lot of these lawsuits are going on for months, sometimes years. And so you're just kind of watching for these developments and getting ready to catch things. Same thing for the census. The 2030 census is coming up. It may seem very far away, but there's a field test for the 2030 census starting next year. And it's a really big step in preparation, and I'm watching, monitoring developments, what we can find out, what is in the works, and how that may affect how accurate the count will be. So a lot of things cooking on the stove, if you will, and just trying to make sure nothing that I have a watch over all of them.
Nothing burns.
Hopefully nothing burns.
So you focus on a lot of really important topics: elections, the census, the Postal Service, other parts of the government. Before we dive into focusing on the Louisiana case, is there one area where in your reporting you feel like, oh, this is an area that's just not well understood, or where there's a lot of misconceptions? I'm in a bubble a little bit because I teach election law and constitutional law. And I'm just wondering, in your reporting, is there something where you think, oh, I wish people understood better this aspect of this particular topic?
I think redistricting. It's something that it's been a challenge for me to fully understand, and I'm still learning as I go, but it is such a critical part of the process of how we set up U.S. democracy. It is this process that is oftentimes behind closed doors, very opaque, very technical, and yet it has this huge role in determining the power of people's vote. You may think, oh, my vote counts just as much as my neighbor's, but that may not necessarily be true depending on how maps are drawn. And this is a process that a lot of people don't think about, don't know about, don't really know how it plays out. Or if they do understand it or have an idea of it, it gets very technical very fast. And it is a process that oftentimes does not involve the public.
So as we ease into the Louisiana case, I think what you said is a really important entry point, which is redistricting affects the power of your vote. Could you say a little bit more about that?
Well, this case in particular is about the Voting Rights Act, which has been, it's a landmark law that has established these longstanding protections to ensure that there is an equal opportunity to exercise voting rights amongst all populations, regardless of race in particular. And that means that in places where voting is racially polarized, meaning that one racial group tends to vote a certain way and another racial group tends to vote a certain way, these are longstanding protections put in place to ensure that racial minority groups aren't shut out of the electoral process, aren't shut out when voting maps are drawn. And sometimes they could be drawn in a way where voting rights advocates, groups of minority voters may sue in court and say, no, this map is drawn in a way that, you know, everyone of this racial minority group can vote and turn out, but there's just no way that they can elect the preferred candidate in this race because of the way maps are drawn.
So let's pick up there and talk about the case we're talking about. As you said, we're talking about the Voting Rights Act, this landmark piece of civil rights legislation. And there were two big pillars to the Voting Rights Act. One is essentially non-operable as a result of the Supreme Court's 2013 decision in Shelby County. And that was part of the Voting Rights Act, which essentially said to some jurisdictions that were, you know, behaving badly, for lack of a better way of describing it, when it comes to voting rights and registration, that they needed to check in with the federal government before they made changes to their voting practices or procedures. That part of the Voting Rights Act is no longer operable. Then, Hansi, as you know, what we're really talking about is the other part of the Voting Rights Act, Section 2. And Section 2 prohibits voting practices and procedures that discriminate on the basis of race. And one of the big areas where there's the most litigation is in the area of redistricting, because as you mentioned, depending on how district lines are drawn, and we're talking about which congressional district you're living in, but also sometimes which state legislative district you're living in, that can affect your ability to elect the candidate of your choosing. And so we don't want those lines to be drawn in a way where people are discriminated against or their voting power is diluted as a result of their race. That's the idea behind the Voting Rights Act. So very briefly, when it comes to Louisiana case, we're talking about a case that's been before the Supreme Court. Hansi, am I right? Two times now, at least?
I guess depending on how you count it. Yeah, that counts. Yeah.
So after the census, Louisiana, like every other state, redrew their district lines. And then there was a challenge by Black voters. And they said that there were not enough majority-minority districts, meaning there was only one Black district. But given the number of Black people in Louisiana, that amounted to a Section 2 violation. And I think the theory was that Black voters were, quote unquote, packed together so that they could elect the candidate of their choosing in one district, but didn't have the ability to do so in another district. And so a district court judge said there is a likely Section 2 violation, at which point Louisiana redrew the district lines. I'm going to turn it back over to you, Hansi, in a minute. Louisiana redraws the district lines. Then non-Black voters sue, and they say, Louisiana, when you redrew those district lines to create another majority-minority district, meaning two Black districts, you took race into account too much, and in fact, you violated the 14th Amendment Equal Protection Clause. Hansi, do I have it right? And is that essentially the case that's pending before the court?
That's basically it. It's a very complicated case, so I'm glad you took on trying to summarize it. But that is basically what came before the Supreme Court this month.
And could you remind us why I said it's been before the Supreme Court at least twice? Obviously, this case is bouncing up and down through the court system for a while now. But this case was actually argued last term, and it came back. Could you talk to us a little bit about why and maybe what changed in terms of the question presented?
Yeah, well this case, like many redistricting cases, often get appealed and appealed and appealed and reach the Supreme Court. And this is a long-running congressional redistricting case that is also tied up with Alabama's congressional redistricting case that the Supreme Court made a major ruling in 2 years ago. And so a lot of back and forth, and ultimately, I guess the most recent development was in June when there was a decision expected in this Louisiana case. The Supreme Court said they actually wanted to hear it again. And then over the summer, it announced it wanted to hear this case again on a specific question. And that question essentially is looking into whether Louisiana's intentional creation of a second majority minority congressional district violates the 14th or 15th Amendments to the U.S. Constitution. And that is a question that a lot of voting rights legal experts I talk to say was answered by the Alabama case that the Supreme Court ruled on. And now this is essentially another opportunity for the court to revisit this topic. And it has opened up this question of whether or not these longstanding Section 2 protections against the dilution of minority voters' collective voting power in places where voting is racially polarized, whether those protections are going to go away because their constitutionality is now up in the air, given what the Supreme Court has asked to hear again.
Well, and you're right. You're alluding to a recent case that the Supreme Court decided, the Milligan case out of Alabama, where it arguably did ask, in my view, a very similar question about the tension between Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which says you cannot dilute people's voting power on the basis of race, and the 14th Amendment and the Equal Protection Clause specifically, where there's some question about whether or not you violate the Equal Protection Clause if you take race into account too much when you're trying to remedy a likely Section 2 violation or just comply with Section 2. And the court, again, a few years ago in the Alabama case, decided not to create a big ruling. It was a 5-4 decision. Chief Justice John Roberts and Justice Kavanaugh joined with the liberals to find that there was essentially not a legal problem with Alabama's maps. And now it feels like everything that's old is new again. And we're hearing arguments in what feels to many people, I think, like a similar case. Could you talk to us a little bit? I know you listened to the oral arguments. Could you talk to us a little bit about the specific things that the justices zeroed in on? And it seemed to me like the arguments were divided a little bit between kind of how do you determine that there is a Section 2 violation, because the current standard is the Jingle standard or the Gingle standard, depending on which justice you are and how you want to pronounce it, and then what you could do to remedy a Section 2 violation. Is that, Hansi, kind of the division that you saw, or were there other big categories that you think are helpful for us to organize our thinking on the oral arguments?
Yeah, it was a long oral, long two and a half hours. And I think to distill it, I think the way I've kind of thought about it is that you have kind of these range of arguments challenging, again, the longstanding protections under Section 2. You have Louisiana, the state of Louisiana, arguing that any use of race in any form, they say, in the redistricting process is unconstitutional. And so you have one end saying no race at all can be used. And I think you have a gradations kind of below that, if you will, of saying, well, no, what is unconstitutional is how Section 2 requires race to be used in the redistricting process. And that is kind of where I saw a lot of the back and forth. And then you also have the liberal justices oftentimes in their questioning pointing out, essentially saying, you know, what are we talking about here? This is a question that has been answered before by the Supreme Court in saying that there is it is constitutional for race to be used in order to remedy a Section 2 violation. It is not the only way to remedy a Section 2 violation, but it is a one possible constitutional possibility. And so that's kind of where things went, I think, in a very distilled way. But you're the law professor. What did you think?
Well, I mean, I think that I agree with you that they were long and complicated. And I'm more curious for your thoughts about, this is always my least favorite when we're thinking about complicated oral arguments, particularly when the court has essentially kind of punted once already and wasn't able to come to a conclusion, which is where we think the justices might be. I mean, what I heard is the liberal justices, Justice Sonia Sotomayor, Elena Kagan, Ketanji Brown Jackson, being comfortable with the idea that you can consider race when remedying a Section 2 violation or a likely violation, or when just making sure that you're complying with Section 2. Then what I heard were the conservative justices, maybe mostly Justice Kavanaugh, but I think some other justices, feeling that there is some sort of temporal aspect that we need to be worried about. And this has echoes of the Affirmative Rights decision, the Affirmative Rights Act decision, where the Supreme Court recently said that affirmative action programs for higher education are unconstitutional, and essentially that they needed to sunset, that there was a time limit in those programs. And I heard justices in the middle espousing something very similar, which is basically how long can you use race as a factor? And then I think I heard some justices really uncomfortable with the idea of using race at all or too much. And obviously too much is doing a lot of work there. But is that kind of the spectrum of what you heard as well as you, you know, explain this case to a broad audience?
I think another, let's throw in another complication.
Yes,
another thing that came up during the oral arguments was how much is this about race versus how much is this about political partisanship, and how much, how should we understand that in what legislatures, when they are redrawing voting maps, what are they factoring in? And is it really about race, or is it really about having a partisan advantage, depending on who's in control of the legislation, who's trying to draw maps in their favor, in their party's favor? I was paying attention to Justice Kavanaugh's questions, as well as Chief Justice John Roberts's questions in particular, because, like you said, the last big ruling from the Supreme Court on this question came out of the Alabama congressional redistricting case. And that was a case where you saw Roberts and Kavanaugh join the three liberal justices. And you also saw Justice Kavanaugh put out, and I believe it was a concurring opinion, put out saying after when the ruling came out that he raised this question of this temporal argument of, you know, essentially, you know, at what point is should there be an end date to when race can be allowed to be used in this redistricting process, particularly even for protecting the voting rights of racial minorities. And so that was a topic that Justice Kavanaugh brought up multiple times in his questioning. And I think that is potentially something to watch for in terms of what the Supreme Court, a majority, may put out in terms of their ruling, that at the end of the day, there might be a majority there that votes to decide that these longstanding protections against racial discrimination and redistricting, that they should be expired, that they are no longer constitutional.
Yes. I mean, that did feel like it was looming pretty large over the oral arguments. Before we leave, I was also listening to Justice Barrett. And because I often listen to her in the sense of I find her to be a very helpful questioner in terms of focusing the party's arguments. And I heard her at the end, I believe, maybe asking the Department of Justice what their middle ground, I don't think middle ground is the best way to describe it because it's not really in the middle, but what their proposal really looks like, and kind of kicking the tires on that. Before we leave oral arguments, could you tell us a little bit about how the Department of Justice's argument here maybe differs from that of Louisiana.
Louisiana is arguing, or state of Louisiana argued during oral arguments, because their position has shifted during this litigation. But during oral arguments, they were arguing that race should play no role in any form in the redistricting process, or take out race completely. Any use of race is unconstitutional. And what the Justice Department has put forth in their briefs to the Supreme Court and then during oral arguments is to say, no, race can play a role, but they have a problem. The Justice Department says it is unconstitutional the way that how Section 2 has been interpreted by the courts for decades. And in the process of reviewing the circumstances of an area, that race is playing an improper role, and that there should be in some way a consideration, more so a consideration of partisan politics. I'm still wrapping my head around the DOJ proposal. That's my best.
I will also say, I think you do an excellent job, as I said in the intro, of explaining these really difficult topics to an audience that is engaged and interested and by definition going to be mixed level in terms of their education in these areas and expertise in these areas. So I'm going to give it a 10 out of 10. And
Thank you.
As we work our way out of the case, could you explain to us, because we're hearing so much about partisan redistricting, which is something that you've helped us focus on. And as we remember, it's now more than a decade ago, I believe, the Supreme Court said that claims that district lines are drawn in a way that amount to a partisan gerrymander are something called not justiciable, meaning that federal judges cannot weigh in on that question. And so if you claim that your lawmakers drew lines in order to try and increase or maintain political power, you have no recourse in federal court. And so that puts more pressure on claims that there are lines that could amount to a racial gerrymander. Now, all of which is to say, obviously, I'm talking to you from California. We are, what, now 10 days away from voting on a ballot measure that would allow us to temporarily suspend our independent redistricting commission and draw lines to increase the number of Democrats in the House. Why? Because we're responding to Texas, as they are likely to redraw district lines that would increase the number of Republicans in the House. So all of this is happening mid-cycle, which I'm sure, Hansi, is making you much busier than you usually are when it comes to redistricting, because usually that's kind of every 10 years and then there's lawsuits that we follow. But back to Louisiana, could this case have an impact on the kind of blatant partisan gerrymandering that we see throughout the country?
It can. And depending on when the Supreme Court rules, it could have an immediate effect on the next year's midterm election. The Supreme Court usually rules in these major cases in June, towards the end of its term. But the Supreme Court does what it does when it wants to do it, essentially. And so it could decide to put out a ruling earlier, which is what the state of Louisiana has asked for, or a ruling by early January, in order to finalize maps for the congressional election, next year's congressional election. And there was a report out recently by two voting rights advocacy groups, Fair Fight Action and Black Voters Matter Fund. And they did analysis looking at, what could the effect be if the Supreme Court were to rule that states no longer have to follow the Voting Rights Act Section 2 protections against racial discrimination as they are currently written. And it found that it could open up a path for Republicans to redraw up to 19 more House districts in their favor. And we're talking about mostly southern states where this would happen. And these are states where Republicans either control both the legislative chambers, state legislative chambers, the governor's office, or they have a veto-proof majority in the legislature, and where voting is racially polarized. And this would mean Louisiana, Florida, Georgia, Missouri, North Carolina, and Texas could end up with fewer Democratic representatives in Congress, and Alabama, Mississippi, South Carolina, and Tennessee could lose all of their Democratic representatives in terms of racial minority representation in Congress, as much as 30% of the Congressional Black Caucus and 11% of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus could also be lost if Section 2 protections against racial discrimination and redistricting as they currently stand are thrown out or weakened in some way. And this is a possibility that could open up the door for Republicans cementing one-party control of the House of Representatives for at least a generation. Because again, as you say, the federal Supreme Court has ruled in 2019 that partisan gerrymandering claims are not revealable by federal courts. And some states allow partisan gerrymandering, some states don't. And so you have a patchwork of policies, and you're seeing that, we're all seeing that playing out in this mid-decade congressional redistricting war that's playing out between different states, a really bare knuckles, knockdown, drag out fight to eke out as much partisan advantage that could be squeezed out of these maps in time for next year's midterm election, so that, you know, for the Republicans, they're trying to hold on to their slim majority, and Democrats are trying to fight against that.
I think that was an excellent explanation of how this case impacts what's happening in these mid-cycle redistricting efforts and why these efforts are so consequential, because we do have a House of Representatives that is so closely divided, and five votes in either direction could make a big difference. I think we should leave it there. You really helped bring us through the complexity of the case, redistricting itself, and then talking about how it matters to the rest of us. So Hansi Lo Wang of NPR, I'm so happy to have had you as a guest, and thank you so much for being with us.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.